right, welcome back in again to another episode of The Scenario Sports. I appreciate everybody making it. We took a down week last week. There are a couple of things going on that I wanted to let the tides pass to put together, but we're back again with the full program here for you. This is your host, Matt Whitener. Actually, you know what? Last week, and actually I was, I'm going to get to introducing our returning guest, who's also got a lot of appearances in this already, but I actually was getting busy with our political show last week. So trying to get that together, getting that, especially with election day coming up. So be sure everybody to check out Politics as Usual, featuring Chris Carter and DeMarco Davidson, breaking down a lot of ballots. A lot of it was really St. Louis specific in this last one, but there's topics on there that help everybody understand your ballot and what's ahead of you on there. So again, that, check out that and everything else on the Straight Outta Low Cash Network here, but you're here for Scenario Sports. So we'll chop into that. Introduce my co-host riding with me today once again, Mr. Jason Klinkscales, and a special guest as well. I mean, it would be wrong for us not to acknowledge everybody in the room.
No, you got to acknowledge my co-worker.
I'll give you the honor. Yeah, I wanted to make sure we got his title right. I wanted to give you the honors of introducing Ellis.
So yes, this is my. I still can't believe I have a kid. This is my son, Ellis. He is going to be 2 years old in less than 2 weeks. It's my son. he is also, I'm also his assistant, basically. It's funny. It's like, oh, you know, the whole mother-father label to me doesn't work, because the truth is I am his assistant and my wife's assistant. I'm just kind of here.
I do what they need to do. Life is funny because it's circular that way, right? Like, you want to get back to the point of having an assistant after you've been an assistant already. Yeah. You know, you had assistants when you were born, but now you want to get back to having them again in life. It all comes full circle that way. And I choose to see us more as indentured servants, maybe. There's a little bit of payoff in the husband wife game, but more often than not, we're just doing what we can to make life easy for them.
No, literally, there have been times in the past, even before little guy was born, my tiny human was born, where with my wife's friends, I would just leave the message, be like, this is Mr. Klinkscales, Dr. So-and-so's assistant. And it's like, and those are her best friends, and they're friends of mine too. And then we would kind of continue the calls that way, because that's the truth. And so now, you know, with tiny human here, it's like I have no breaks. I'm not a member of a union. It's kind of tough labor, but at the same time, you know, when he wants to sit here with me and be all nice and cuddly and cute for a few moments, it's kind of nice. These are the fringe benefits.
Well, maybe this footage will be worth something one day. He'll make his debut in a major way, and this is the type of thing that goes back and they remember us for who we were, if anything, and then I remember him for who he is. We never know.
Yeah, that's the life.
In some unique ways.
That's the life.
So,
all right, you go ahead and change his channel, kid.
One thing that I actually didn't do with you the first time you came on the show, and I remembered it during our last episode when the much esteemed Michael Tillery came on, I didn't have you state your allegiances your first time through. That's the thing I do with everybody that comes on the show. I think it's really important that people understand people's four core allegiances, as far as whether it's a team. These days, it's something like athletes. Sometimes people have more allegiance to athletes than they do the teams.
Yeah, I'll get on a rant
about that one day. That's not my lifestyle. That's not the way I've chosen to be a sports fan. But not that there's anything wrong with that. But for you, man, I need to know your four core allegiances, man. So who do you ride for? Who are your teams?
Here's the thing.
Where did that get started at?
Here's the thing. Like, I can't even say if there's four anymore, because, you know, so much has changed in terms of the way I view sports and the way I consume sports. And we've seen how, let's say, like the NFL and Major League Baseball have managed to tick off a lot of people. And I've certainly been among them. But it's also weird, because even though I'm born and raised in New York City, I'm not big into the whole hometown loyalty thing. I'm really not. And especially when teams give you reason to not be loyal, whether it's lack of entertainment or a bunch of other reasons. And I preface that to say that somehow, some way, I'm still a New York Knicks masochist.
So are the Knicks your first love? Is that your first? My first love is the St. Louis Cardinals.
Yes.
So, I mean, that's, no matter what happens, that's going to be the longest love.
Yeah, the Knicks are my first love. And it's funny, because, like, they're not the ones who introduced me to basketball. I mean, yes, I came of age in the Jordan era. But like, I just fell in love with the Ewing era, the Ewing Starks, Oakley, Mason, Harper era, and I've stuck there since. And to me, there's also there's a big social connection with that, with the city. For better or for worse, this is gonna be a whole nother show, and I can even start my own network to talk about this. But to me, the most New York team there is in New York are the Knicks, for better or for worse. They exemplify the city's best and worst. And certainly right now it's exemplifying its worst. But you know, the Knicks always had a stronger connection to what I would consider Black New York than all the other teams. So that's part of the reason why I think a lot of us, for better or for worse, we stick with that. But I would say the Knicks are a core passion. Quasi Rangers, because, you know, 94 was such an incredible year. But, you know, the New York Rangers, you know, are there. But I also follow the Bayern hockey. So it's the tiers weren't that strong. They weren't that heavy over this past season. I actually grew up a 49ers fan. I grew up a San Francisco 49ers fan. They were my first love. So I grew up, you know, loving Jerry Rice, obviously the Montana Rice connection, and then to Youngin Rice. But then I covered the New York Giants for a few seasons, and I ended up becoming sort of a conscientious objector, if you will, when came with the NFL. And then with baseball, that's the weird thing too. I was a Braves fan for a while. I was an Atlanta Braves fan for quite a bit. Because in a lot of ways as well, they had a little more color, a little more melanin than most of the other teams I kind of, you know, that we were seeing in baseball as time progressed.
So that's interesting that you're in a city, born and bred in New York, and with two baseball teams, although I know it's not that simple. I know that there are dividing lines and that it works out one way or the other, you know, because if I remember right, there's Mets Jets fans and there's Yankees Giants fans.
Yes.
Okay, so it kind of works out that way.
If you want to do delineation, it would be Mets, Jets, Nets. Those people actually exist. but it's really Mets, Jets, Islanders, right? And then it's Yankees, Giants, Rangers, and for the longest time, and then you would say Knicks, but really the longest time, the only common thread between those groups were the Knicks. The Nets were obviously an uneven franchise, so it didn't really – it wasn't that strong connection there. But, yeah, for me, it was less about, you know, the city loyalties. Although, look, I went to the games all the time. I don't hate those teams. I never did. I do have issues with ownership of those franchises. I have issues with some of the culture around the fan base. I mean, yes, every fan base is very – you know, they all have the same behaviors, but some are a little bit more – extra than others. Okay. And it never sat well with me as a sports fan, especially like I'm one of the few people I can say I've never booed at a stadium. I guess because I've always tried to understand where the players are coming from and I understand like, hey, things aren't perfect. I never got fully with a lot of the fan behavior. I never really got with a lot of that fan entitlement. Although somebody's probably gonna break out the picture someday. Back in 1996, I was in the ninth grade. And I have a picture of myself. Mama's coming home soon. I have a picture of myself with a Yankees banner because it was extra credit in my English class. So before somebody tries to dig up the pictures and say like, oh, you were a Yankee fan. It's like, nah, I really wasn't. I wanted that extra credit. But again, I never, here you go. You can have a phone, just go ahead. And now he's gonna call 911 six times. Yeah, I just, you know, my sports loyalties were always different in a way. My parents' sports loyalties were a little bit different. It didn't mean that you didn't pay attention to what was going on. It was just more like there were sort of players that kind of drew me in a certain direction, and then I became a fan of the team, and especially if the team was a contention. You know, the Braves obviously were the team of the 90s, if you will, up until, you know, the end of the later end of the decade. But they also had Andrew Jones, who was like, to me, one of the most uncanny, incredible defensive players ever. And I loved watching him. I was a Chipper Jones fan. And I just kind of became a fan of everybody else.
Yeah.
That was the Braves. That's why I didn't really go with the Yankees Mets divide. In terms of football, to me, it was easy because the Niners were the shit.
Right. I'm still a Niners fan. I was a Niners fan back then before the same thing. I mean, late 80s, if you're, you know, that's who was on. And for me, it was a little bit more complicated because we didn't have a team in my city between 88 and 94. And that was really when I was coming of age with paying attention to that sport. So mm-hmm. I just stuck with the Niners, and it's funny because now I have friends that played for the Rams, and it's mm-hmm. like I still am a Niners fan, and they're aware of it. But here's the funny thing about guys like that: they have teams too. Even mm-hmm. though one of the great conversations I had one time, it says that you're always loyal to your college program for them. You're mm-hmm. always loyal to your college program, but you always have an appreciation for your pro team. But it's different yeah. because that's mm-hmm. business. And one of them literally hits at your heartstrings. And I was like, that's an interesting way to look yeah. at it. And that's kind of the way that it's evolved for me too. Maybe in a little bit of an opposite sense though, you know, sure. So it's weird that way.
Yeah, and you mentioned something interesting about the college relationship. So, you know, here in New York City, and this is the other thing too, the reason why it wasn't a big deal for me to not be 100% on the hometown teams. For better or for worse, this is the biggest front-running city there is. I mean, we're not going to admit it, but we are. And this is even for our home teams. So, you know, the Linsanity era with the Knicks, that was when people were suddenly down about it, and then they got back into it, even though, don't tell anybody, the Knicks were better the next season. But
Linsanity is your equivalent. Linsanity for New Yorkers is like the Mark McGwire home run race for us. The Cardinals the Cardinals were not good while he was hitting all those home runs.
Right.
But they got a lot better 2 years after, I think. And that happens to coincide with when Albert Pujols showed up. But
right. You know, and that's what it is. If certain people show up, right? Because look, the Yankees were briefly second fiddle until, you know, 94, when people thought maybe they could make it to the World Series, and then the strike happened. And if the strike didn't happen, they would have went to the World Series and got demolished by Montreal.
But you mean the Don Mattingly loss?
Yeah.
That's too bad.
And it's very interesting. Like in the city, like, you know, people front run for the hometown teams as well. But I also think that, you know, when it comes to baseball, for example, you have Yankees, Mets, and then you have a group of everybody else. Because again, you have 8.6 million people in 5 boroughs. And a lot of people are not from New York, and they're going to hold on to their hometown loyalties. You know, we're a unique city where there is a bar for every team there is in professional sports and collegiate sports.
I went to a Missouri Tigers bar in New York.
Yeah, exactly.
It was among the strangest experiences in my life. It was like I was in New York. It was a ramen spot like right across the street. I turned this door and I was in mid Missouri. It was one of the strangest. It was like a wormhole almost.
And to that point, what I was going to make about, you know, the pro and college thing, that is where the college sports play a role here in New York, where like, it's not about, you know, yeah. In the late 80s and the 90s, there was the big St. John's push, obviously, mm-hmm. when St. John's was actually good. And like, not that they weren't good later in the 90s, but they weren't like, you know, competing for the national title, right? No. But it was more like there were the college sports loyalties in New York City are more about this is where I went to school. There mm-hmm. isn't that collective, like everybody in the city roots for one school. It doesn't right. really work that way because college sports, while they're a big deal, the born, raised, bred, especially black and brown folks who are here, that loyalties in the college sports aren't as strong as they were for, you know, previous generations, certainly a lot of white folks and stuff like that. Because I do think they were, and I have to mention the racial thing, like that does play a role in terms of how we perceive and how we root for sports in a way.
Absolutely.
I think with college sports, like the people who are loyal to UConn, they're going to stick with UConn. The people who are loyal to whatever other Big East schools, that's what they're sticking with. But a lot of black and brown folks were like, you know, no matter where they were in the country, they rooted for Georgetown in the late 80s and the 90s because they thought they were at HBCU, right?
It took me a long time to realize that all 12 black people at Georgetown played basketball. It took me a long time to figure that out.
Right. And Georgetown's a beautiful school. I've been there a couple times and, you know, but I was shocked too. Like, wow, it's not as black as I thought it would be, even though it's in D.C.
It's still stunning that Allen Iverson went to that school.
And that's the thing. I thought he just went there for 1 year, but maybe it was two. Because you know him and Stephon Marbury came out the same year, in that loaded.
So then it had to be 2 years because Allen Iverson was not in Marbury. It might have been 3 years because Iverson was not in Marbury's high school class.
Yeah, but I think they came out. They were the same draft year though.
They were, but that's I'm saying that lets me know that Iverson was there for at least 2 years then. Yeah,
we have to go back and check because I don't remember where it was with Iverson's. That's the thing. His college career was so legendary in a way, but it was very brief. You know, that's what's kind of an incredible story about it. But yeah, that's the whole thing.
The miracle of the internet. 2 years. He got there. He got there in the 94-95 season and 95-96, which is one of the great Big East years of all time. 95-96, and then if you toss in, if you toss in UMass being up around that same thing with Marcus Camby and those guys at the same time, that was a great time for basketball in the Upper Northeast.
Yeah, yes, it was. It was a lot more. I mean, it was certainly a lot more fun. It was. I think, you know, there's always been this bizarre so-called divide between NBA fans and college basketball fans. But especially up here in the Northeast and definitely in New York City, like, we didn't care. Because in a lot of ways, we're a pro-snob city. It is, listen, we want to see the guys who can make it to the next level, as well as the guys who grew up with who are playing ball. And I think there was a lot of loyalties there. I mean, I grew up with, I grew up with Kenny Satterfield, who was the point guard for Cincinnati Bearcats, who was running point with Kenny Martin, who was National Player of the Year, number one draft pick and all that. I got one steal from him once in a basketball game. It took forever, but I got it. But there were a lot of guys that I grew up with. There were a lot of guys that, you know, most of us grew up with who went into like the top college basketball program.
Yeah.
So the loyalty for, you know, especially a lot of us Black and, you know, Latino guys and girls who were into college sports, the loyalty was not so much to the program. It was more like, yo, we know this dude, or we know guys like this, or we played against guys like this.
And real quick, because we do got a couple of things we want to get to, why is basketball so much different in New York?
Because
everywhere, you probably are aware, I mean, you're aware of it being from there, but everywhere else, you know, looks to New York, you know.
Well, I mean, now they're looking down on it and laughing, but, you know, I think... I mean, Chicago could speak to it in its own story. Los Angeles could speak to it in its own story. And let me just say this, like, I'm the weirdest person in the world where, like, I don't believe, like, in this whole thing of, like, New York plays the best basketball in the country or Chicago. I don't care about that, to be honest with you. But I think with New York, there's a few things that may be almost political in a way. But I think it all goes back to this one significant event in 1957. When all of a sudden, these teams, the New York Giants and the Brooklyn Dodgers, were gone. Gone for their few years, gone out to the West Coast. And those are the teams that had the strong representation of Black athletes in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're talking about the Willie Mays, Monte Irvin, New York Giants era. And then you had, obviously, Jackie Robinson and all those historic guys in the Brooklyn Dodgers. When those two teams left, there was a massive void in terms of Black athletes to pay attention to in New York City. The Yankees may have been dominating across the bridge in the Bronx, and I actually don't live that far away, you know, from there. But Elston Howard didn't come into his own yet, if you will. He wasn't, and he was a good player, but he wasn't like Willie Mays, Jackie Robinson. He wasn't that player.
Yeah, I mean, the shine was still on Mickey Mantle. The shine was shortly thereafter on Roger Maris. The shine was, you know, Whitey Ford, those guys, you know, it wasn't.
And football was, you know, especially the NFL, it was hitting its stride. But again, especially the NFL, I think it's an under-discussed part of football history that the 50s and the 60s, while integration was really coming to the fold, it wasn't really integrated like that. And so there was no pull. But the Knicks were the team that kind of pulled everybody in, because not long after they were founded, you know, the league was pretty much integrated. The NBA was pretty much integrated. So then all of a sudden you had Nat Sweetwater Clifton and Earl Lloyd and those other guys. And those guys kind of helped build the foundation of the franchise. But it was like, you know, we had Black players and the way the NBA was constructed back then, because it being more of a regional draft rather than a, you know, all lottery kind of thing, the Knicks and obviously teams around the Northeast in general were able to kind of grab like the top players who played in colleges nearby. And therefore that kind of helped build the stardom there, attract more Black fans. And I think from there, it just inspired more people to get involved in basketball. Now flip that also to a very interesting urban studies sort of conversation we could have here. it's cheaper to pave some concrete and put basketball courts up than to maintain baseball fields.
Absolutely.
And in those the two convergences of the rise of the Knicks, along with the development of more, well, the tear down of some baseball fields and the rise of more basketball courts, I think those coincided. And so then you can have a guy like Julius Erving, who grew up mostly on Long Island, but played a lot of ball in New York, yeah, to kind of, you know, have a little fun here. You can have Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Lou Alcindor at the time, obviously. You can have all these incredible talent here. And let's not forget, you know, even before them, you know, Lenny Wilkins, who was a Hall of Fame basketball player, Brooklyn guy, who became a Hall of Fame coach as well. Yeah. We had all these different people who were coming into the mix. You had a development of playground basketball and streetball, all coinciding with the rise of the Knicks. And I think that's when a lot of, you know, Black and brown kids said, like, yo, this is a sport we can play. This is something that we can really do. And this is something that we can own without worrying about, you know, okay, we can't find a field. You can get on the court, or you can actually just go ahead and put like a wire rim in your own house, like, you know, a lot of us did, and play ball at home. Or actually in my elementary school, they literally painted a line on like a fence bar.
And that's so many ways. That's one of the gifts of basketball and actually soccer too. You can do it so many different ways. I mean, we ran down some grass and played on a dirt court in my neighborhood. You know, we had a couple of courts and parks that were, you know, the double rim net things and all that. But I mean, we just put a rim up anywhere we could and played. So that's the strength of what basketball does and its accessibility and why it's going to be a sport that always lasts and always has an impact. And I think it's always smart to tie it back to the economic situation on where the game rises from.
And also keep in mind, look, New York City is, despite the gentrification that's going on, New York City is 25% Black, right? Mm-hmm. Even though it's a mostly white city, you know, it's still heavily minority in those scales, right? And so you have,
there's more Black people in New York than there in all the people in St. Louis. Like, just look at it that way. So, I mean, look, St. Louis is not a small city. So, I mean, still accounting for a lot of people.
We have the largest, outside of like southern states per se, like our Black population mirrors a lot of southern states. I mean, mm-hmm. We have, like I said, 8.6 million people in the city. About 2 million are Black. And most of us live in where I'm at in Harlem or out in Brooklyn or in the Bronx and Queens. Like, we live everywhere. But it's this, something that fits us, something that we get to build, something that we get to sort of tell our own stories with. That's, you know, the rise of basketball here in New York City is very, it mirrors very much the rise and the growth of, you know, rap and hip hop here in New York as well, because the situations around them, circumstances around them were very similar. Yeah. And I think that's where, I mean, also we were known for point guards as well. Even though Lou Alcindor / Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is arguably the best player to ever come out of New York, you know, we were a point guard city. And there are some Brooklynites that want to take credit for Michael Jordan. Michael Jordan was born in Brooklyn, but he only lived here for like 3 days.
Right.
He was born in a veterans hospital in Brooklyn. There's no credit there. But the thing is, like, but we claim that because it is part of the story, saying like, hey, the so-called greatest player of all time was born here. So we can at least claim that's our story. And so I think that's all these convergences, you know, socioeconomic factors on top of just, you know, the Knicks filled the void of the Dodgers and the Giants leaving. I think that all kind of made us what we are as a basketball city. And when basketball's on here, when the Knicks are good, like Yankee fans, even people who were like diehard, like, you know, Yankee fans, they cannot deny when the Knicks are a good team, there's nothing that compares in the city. Nothing.
I believe it. I mean, I've lived through Super Bowls in my town. I've lived through Stanley Cups. Mm-hmm. Nothing touches a World Series here. Nothing touches a World Series here. And even a playoff run has the level of what championship is for other sports. So that's a great way to segue into what we just finished up with, the 2020 World Series, which was a long way away from both New York and St. Louis. But, you know, it still went down and it delivered. You know,
it was fun.
The Los Angeles Dodgers got their first championship in 32 years. That's just incredible. And later on, I want to talk about, you know, what that means and just how crazy of a situation that looks like, that it's 32 years since a team that's that notable won. Mm-hmm. And I think that also hold some relevance to like the Knicks and a couple of other franchises.
But we'll
come back around to that though.
You'll make me cry,
Because the order of the day in baseball of late has been teams making good on promises deferred. Last year we had the Washington Nationals, who had just been, just bludgeoned despite being a very strong expansion-esque franchise, in their early years of their franchise, not even getting into the second tier. And I say expansion-esque because I look at the Nationals and the Expos as being two very different things. The way that the Expos were pared down and how they became the Nationals, it was even more egregious than the Sonics and the Thunder. But that's a conversation for
us. I agree with that, actually.
Yeah. But with these Dodgers, I mean, it was a very fascinating run. And I'm going to say this, it was now or never, no matter how long the season went for the Dodgers.
Yeah, absolutely.
They make the big trade that just, the can you believe it trade to get Mookie Betts shortly before spring training gets started back in the spring. The season goes on the shelf for 4 months. And then it's like, well, is this team going to get to actually use Mookie Betts? Like, is he ever going to play for them? And not only does he not play for them, he hits kind of the nail in the coffin home run to win that World Series for them against the Rays. So there's a couple of things I want to get into with you about that. But before we do that, obviously, before we talk about the game, I want to talk about what happened after the game. This season ended in as 2020 of a way as possible in every way, shape, or form.
It's the most appropriate way to end the season for baseball.
I mean, and just a stunningly just like, okay, I guess this is where we're at type of thing. So surprisingly, a guy like Justin Turner, third baseman for the Dodgers, who's been one of the surprising heart and soul guys of the last decade or so, who, really has been there through the rise of that team and through the struggles and the downs they've had. And, was a guy that come back to New York, who got cut loose by the Mets. He just got outrighted because they say he wasn't going to be worth what the waivers conversation was going to be, and then transformed himself into just a backbone player for that team, one of the more underrated productive players in the National League over the last decade. But they pull him from the decisive game in the World Series in the seventh inning, I believe, which seems strange, until we found out that a COVID-19 diagnosis came back and got him in the middle of the game and caused for the Dodgers to pull him out. But then, what is it, maybe 5 minutes after they win it, he's back on the field. And I went back and forth with how I feel about this, but it was the most, I want to give you some time to kind of speak to that.
Sure.
Baseball did an amazing job. I think they reported 30 plus days of no COVID activity, nothing, after it literally almost bringing their season to a halt multiple times. For it just to bring to pop its head back up at the end of the road like that was just stunning. So, we talked about the viability of bubbles. We talked about what that looks like. And then in the end, baseball has a successful bubble, I guess. But we'll see.
Well,
what are your thoughts about where that ended up?
Here's the thing. I think the problem is, and maybe we're mislabeling it a bubble because they allowed fans to come inside. And
true.
I think that's, it's hard to call it a bubble when fans, and yes, I guess they were tested and whatnot, but because we're dealing with something that, you can be asymptomatic and pass it on. You're carrying it, you can pass it on. I think it's really hard to call it successful when you're bringing in a potential of fans who can make this a super spreader event. And so that in itself is still like astounds me that they decided that they need to do this. Now, the thing is, in a business sense, I understand why they were pushing for that, because, for better or for worse, baseball, while it has made a gobs amount of money out of television, it still needs the revenue. It still needs the ticket gate revenue and concessions and all this. So I understand that. And it's not like they can go back and try to ask Fox and ESPN and Turner Networks, hey, can y'all give us a little more money to hold us down and all that stuff? They couldn't ask insurance companies to help them out, because and that's a whole separate conversation as well. But like, there were things that they couldn't all of a sudden make up their money, right? So I get it. But they created such an incredibly irresponsible environment by just introducing the idea, let alone then actually executing on the idea, letting fans come into stadiums in Texas. Like that it was incredibly irresponsible. There's nothing more. I think it's why for myself, like, this World Series was a little hard to enjoy completely. It was a fun World Series. It was great to actually see the two best teams in the league the whole year actually play each other in the World Series.
And one of which being a team that everybody knows, and the other one being one that a lot of people didn't know. You know, there are a lot of people that were clamoring for the Yankees to get there. And I said, I think you want to see this Rays team. I think that if you haven't watched this year, the name brand of the Yankees makes a lot of sense. Just the same way that the Celtics playing the Lakers in the NBA Finals would have made a lot of sense in that regard. But this Rays team is the one you want to see.
Look, you want baseball, and we'll get into that a little bit, but like, if you want baseball to exemplify its best, you don't want it to always be stars. You don't always want to go that way. We had that a couple years ago when it was these very Dodgers and Mookie Betts play on the other side for the Red Sox.
True.
And guess what? You had the second biggest market in the country and the 7th or 8th, depending on how it flips with San Francisco when it comes to Boston. And that was the lowest rated World Series at the time. Mm. So it's kind of, you realize like the brand doesn't always matter. And I think we're starting to understand that now a little bit more than we had in the past. But here you wanted to see, with all the crap that MLB put its fans through, all the crap that MLB put everybody through in general, just to get a season going, you at least wanted to end with like the best teams showing you why they were the best teams. Tampa actually showed that in its own right. But the Dodgers were just so much better.
This Dodgers team had the potential that if you would have got an opportunity to see the entire season play out and to see how it would have went over a full 162. I mean, I believe they were on a 116 win pace, which
they were going to be great. They were a great team. But they were going to be like, they were going to be historical.
Yeah, it would have been something. This was a season where there were going to be some seasons, if they would have played out, there would have been ones to remember. You know, Shane Bieber, you know, the thing that all sorts of people that, you know, it was a great pitch season, but there were all sorts of teams that were doing some incredible things as well. Some teams that were on the verge, you know, and I look at that and it brings me back to the original point about the Dodgers, where this, if the stakes already were as high as they were, and saying that at this point, what more can we do? We brought the 2018 AL MVP to play with the 2019 NL MVP. You know, you've got an emergent star in Walker Buehler. You've got a a breakout star that's coming to be in young guys like Gavin Lux, who didn't quite pan out, but it was a big name at the time. Walker Buehler, who's going to be, you know, one of the next big things on the mound. Of course, with Clayton Kershaw, who, you know, really was carrying the bag on his back for a lot of these struggles with the club and what it looked like. Everything just said that it had to be this year. So the Dodgers had to feel the pressure of, if we're going to play, we got to make everything we can out of this season, because tomorrow never knows. But we do know that it's come up with, I think this was their 5th straight AL West title. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, they were on the verge of a potentially, and I guess that maybe they're not completely out of the woods with this yet, but a Braves-like run where they're the bridesmaid and that's what they come to be defined as.
Yeah, and what's interesting about them is that...
90s Braves, by the way, I'm sorry.
Right. What's interesting about these Dodgers is that, you know, they are the big spending team that also does play to the analytics, but they also realize, listen, man, that can only go so far if we don't have talented guys. And if we don't put together, like, they built a core, they have a lot of homegrown guys. And that's what also makes the Dodgers special. While they spent a lot of money, they spent money to keep players.
Yeah.
I mean, you're keeping Kershaw around for as long as you did. And that in itself is impressive. Justin Turner was able to get the contract, and, you know, he's a free agent after this. So we'll see. I mean, I don't think anybody can imagine him leaving LA. But like,
it would be interesting. They've got some tough calls coming up, but you know, at the end of the day, they still have the pockets to make it happen.
That's what makes them special. Like, you know, and then you grab Mookie Betts and like, you got to find a way to keep him around. And it's hard to imagine they won't keep him, because he's going to be a cornerstone of the franchise.
Well, I mean, he's already on the 12-year extension. He's there.
Oh, he's there. Right. So there you go. Now he's the cornerstone of the franchise for the next 12 years, or maybe sooner than that, depends on, you know, financial ramifications down the line. But like, you have, they have a great mix of homegrown guys along with the right trades and the right free agents. They didn't just try to make a hodgepodge. They didn't just go ahead, pull up a PlayStation and make all sorts of overrides in their deals. Like, no, they actually picked fairly well. And even before, you know, this World Series, even before Betts, they actually made the mostly the right moves. I would still love to have seen Yasiel Puig on his team because he just fit the dynamics so well. But hey, he eventually flipped into Mookie Betts. And I think that's something that anybody would trade for, because you get a guy like that who is already pushing a Hall of Fame path, if you will, in Betts, you got to pull that trigger. But I think that the Dodgers are such an interesting team because in this era of baseball where people talk so much about, you know, playing to the numbers, playing to the analytics, while there's a manager on the field, the guy who really is making the decisions about who plays and who doesn't play is the general manager and all that. It's the formula that's making the decisions. The Dodgers are like, yeah, we could do that, but like if these guys can't play. And there is still something to the nature of Dave Roberts, who, you know, he's like all great managers. He's going to be maligned for the decisions that he made that didn't turn out. That's just baseball. But he knows who he's dealing with. He knows his roster incredibly well. Sure. He knows who has and who doesn't have it that particular day at a particular time. He usually the best manager is the guy who knows how to pull the right levers. And for the most part, he's done that. So I think the Dodgers is such a fascinating franchise in that they're almost kind of old school in a way.
The thing I really loved about this World Series is, you know, is how many subplots collided for that team. It's interesting to see how many things worked out for them all at once. You know, you have Dave Roberts, who becomes the first African-American manager and first African-American as a manager and a player to win the World Series. That's huge. I mean, that's great. That's becoming a historical footnote with that. You also have a guy, you know, we talk about all these other guys. You talk about a top prospect who had injuries, who was out, who resurrected himself this year. And that being Corey Seager, you know, who was another homegrown guy who is. Yeah, I mean, just an incredible season. He's the LCS and the World Series MVP, by the way, between all of this. But you have the guys like Kershaw, who absolutely exercised his postseason demons, played well. If it wasn't Seager, it probably would have been him as the World Series MVP.
Absolutely.
You know, but you also have the guys that you're happy to have be there. Kenley Jansen, who, you know, is definitely on the downside of what he is, but played a huge, huge role in just keeping that team at the level it's been at for so long.
And so, going back to the whole thing with Justin Turner, like, and the reason why people were so crazy about that, Jansen had COVID. He was out of action for a couple of weeks and was able to come back and somewhere. And because, you know, we unfortunately saw him with his health issues even before the season. You know, I think it was an issue with his heart a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. For him to be able to still perform well enough to be on a major league roster, to still command a presence to be the closer of the franchise of the team for a period of time, like that is an incredible effort for him to try to come back to some level of what he used to be after everything he dealt with physically over the last couple of years. So, I mean, you have to be happy for him because that's a lot to deal with.
Yeah, the Dodgers have done what a lot of other big ticket teams have failed to do. They've staggered out the success of their team. They've got waves of different people. You've got the people you went out to go get, but you've also got the people that you've grown, and they've made smart deals with it. Now, granted, most teams can't do what the Dodgers did. Very few teams have the ability to make the diversity of directions that they did all at once. You know, which includes bringing in Andrew Friedman from Tampa Bay to execute the strategy and to bring somebody with that smaller market makeup into big market resources. That's a huge thing. You know, the ownership group being as invested in them as possible and the things that happen with that. You know, you can't really replicate some of those things, but they also showed that to some of the teams, like, let's call them the Yankees, teams like the Cubs, teams like the Red Sox, who have all of this money. Oh, look across town. The Angels, who are just probably the most diametrically opposed franchises in all of sports that inhabit one city, being the Dodgers and the Angels. We'll talk about that right now. But they did what it took to consolidate those things and show what it means to build around the talent that not only they've acquired, but they've grown. And they really hit on everything. And the only thing missing was this World Series. And they got it done. But Dodgers, Angels. One fantastic thing that's been missing from baseball that you've got in every other sport right now, whether it's the quarterback battle in the NFL, whether it's the battle player versus player in the NBA, even, you know, to an extent, you've got like the Sidney Crosby, Alex Ovechkin type of thing that's gone on in hockey for a long time. You finally now have the shapes of people getting a chance to see Mookie Betts And I don't know why it took so long to see him. I don't know why it's taken so long to see Mookie, because he's been very hard to miss over this incredible career he's had so far. But for whatever reason, it's finally hit. Maybe it's the fact of him being the only African-American playing in the World Series. Maybe it's the fact that he's playing for the Dodgers and doing what he's done. But the conversation is now here about who really is the best player in baseball. For so long, it's been Mike Trout. You know, by discussion, by talking point, by award, by acclaim, by rightful inheritance, it's been Mike Trout, who's been absolutely one of the handful of the greatest players in the history of the game since he started. But right on his ass the entire time has been Mookie Betts.
Absolutely. And what was interesting, because you mentioned bringing on the 2018 AL Most Valuable Player onto the team that already had the 2019 NL Most Valuable Player. That year, I remember, I don't remember if it was something from like the Boston Globe or whatever else, but like Boston media began to ask the question, or at least when the question was asked in 2018, and, you know, I think it was either some people in the Boston media or certainly Boston Red Sox fans all were saying Mookie Betts is the best player in baseball, best player in the game. And people looked at them with like this funny sort of look like, are you kidding me? And I actually didn't disagree with them at that time. Not so much about like believing if he is or he isn't, but it was the idea, the fact that there was a question, that there was actually some legitimate merit to it, because Betts has put up incredible numbers. We know that Mike Trout has gone on this sort of Mickey Mantle / Willie Mays kind of tear, whatever else, but he is doing this for one of the most mismanaged franchises in baseball. And it makes, and it's not that Trout isn't amazing. It's that the Angels are that bad. They were that bad in terms of roster management. They were that bad in terms of just everything. Pitching was never that great. Bullpen was always a frustrating deal. You know, and Trout never had enough protection behind him to truly make him stand out the way that other all-time greats in other sports would stand out on this sort of greater national prominence, right?
Yeah, and that's so, one thing, and that's one thing I'll say about Mike Trout is that, you know, one thing I uphold about baseball is that more often than not in baseball, titles don't define your legacy. You know, how often do you hear a guy in baseball gets brought up and it says, you know, yeah, but he never got a ring. You know, you just don't have that held against guys because there's so many things that go into it. You know, it's a footnote if a guy doesn't win. But is Ken Griffey's legacy damaged at all by the fact he never even played in a World Series? Not really. You know, Barry Bonds got there once, and he absolutely owned it when he was there. God, but, you know, is it a big deal that he didn't win one? Not really. Now, titles do have an opportunity to raise guys up still. It certainly did wonders for Derek Jeter. It certainly did wonders for Mariano Rivera, who were, you know, two of the great competitors of all time at the World Series level. But, you know, you don't hear people say how many World Series Albert Pujols has. He has two, you know, but, you know, it's not a sticking point.
Yeah, and I think to the point of, you know, again, the merit that was behind Betts' campaign, if you will, from the Boston media and the fan base out there, the thing was that part of the reason to the question you're asking, like how people are just realizing how good Betts is, people got so sick and tired of the Red Sox. People got so sick and tired of Boston in general. That, and as I mentioned earlier, the World Series is between the Dodgers and the Red Sox a couple of years ago was at the time the lowest rated, you know, at the time. And it was proof of the fatigue that people had the Red Sox, you know, went from this cute story of breaking the curse in 2004 to all of a sudden they won four world championships in that time, right? And people got tired of it, and they were always in the mix. And also, look, he came up behind David Ortiz. He came up behind a bunch of other really great players who were getting much more shine. Up there. He goes to LA, and when he comes to LA, they were like, yo, he's the piece. He is the missing piece. And that's a different conversation that was being had about Betts versus him being a cog in a wheel. Up in Boston, they still love Dustin Pedroia, former MVP himself, was a very good player when he was healthy, but he's a little bit more beloved up there for different reasons. You know, David Ortiz is a god up there forever. You know, you can run down a list of all these other guys who were sort of, and they love Betts. They definitely love Betts, but it was like he was part of an ensemble in a way, even though there was a period of time in which he may have been their best player. And so he comes into a situation where he clearly was still the best player on the Dodgers, but he was seen as like, yo, he's the guy that's going to get us over the hump. He's the guy that has been here before. He's the guy that's done it. He beat us. And I think there's something really significant with that. And so when he comes into this series, in this postseason, you know, the story is now, it's like, we're all watching this guy. And it's like, yo, holy shit, he's really this good. And because Mike Trout has only had three postseason games, and I think he had one hit, if he had a hit at all.
Yeah.
Whereas you see Betts destroying the ball in every series he's been in. I mean, he didn't have a great game. I think it was game five when he had the golden sombrero, I think, or whatever. But, you know, it was – he's been great every time out. And then his story in particular of, you know, Black kid in Nashville who – there's a great story about him and his mom. His mom basically started a team because the team he wanted to get on, the manager thought he was too small. So mom was like, screw this, I'm gonna make my own team. Like, now those are stories that are incredible. Those are stories that people wanted to get behind. And that's where now more and more people are starting to ask that question because the timing was just right. It was like, this is a guy who proved how good he was. He's not the biggest, far from that, but he has the biggest pop. He has the biggest presence. He has that difference-making bat that helped win championships in Boston and now Los Angeles. And I think, again, the stories just kind of converge at the right time.
I think it's a, I think that I'm going to throw a couple of numbers at you. That's going to kind of just speak to the fact of what Mookie Betts versus Mike Trout is. And you know, for me, I would say I given Mike Trout the honor by acclaim, but I've always thought that Mookie Betts was the second best player. Like it's I was working on a piece this spring before the season fell off the rails about just ranking the best players in the game. Might give it another run again this spring. But, you know, 1 and 2, I started 3. Let's figure out who the third best player in the game is, because 1 and 2 is easy. I think that 1 and 2, taking away the other, you know, 700-plus guys in the game, is a little bit tighter of a conversation than maybe even I was giving it credit for. And I think that you have to give it a little bit more credit following this postseason. So I'm just going to go from 2014 to 2020. Those are the first years that both Betts and Trout were in the league together. Trout's career obviously started in 2011. Mookie started in 2014. But, you know, since that time, you know, Betts has the edge in batting average by a point. You know, so Trout's a 300 hitter during that time. Betts is 301. You know, Trout has obviously dominated in power, you know, in home runs. He has over 100 more runs batted in, but Mookie Betts has over 20 more stolen bases. And when you get the total hits, Mookie Betts is outpacing Trout by a wide enough margin. Yeah. They're the 1 and 2 in baseball and runs scored. But here's the real separation is that, yeah, I'm sure you can look at offense and do that. Mookie is an unparalleled defender in the
outstanding defensive player. Outstanding.
I mean, not only are we talking about one of the best players in baseball right now, we're talking about all time. He might be he might be the best fielding right fielder of all time. You know, we're talking about a guy who has been accountable for over 9 more defensive wins than Trout has as a center fielder, and Betts has spent most of his time in the corner. I mean, and you just look at all the other things that factor into it. I think there's a legitimate claim here to say it's time to really give Mookie his flowers, if you will. And this World Series run and the things he's done on it really speak to the fact that that's due. So kind of turning the corner here with this, the Justin Turner thing was crazy. You know, some schools of thought have said, well, he spent all this time around them already. What's the hurt with him coming back on the field at that point? I get that. There's the optics of the protocol breakdown saying that we chose to not do right when we knew better, whereas saying that we didn't know better beforehand. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's only apt that I cough at that moment. But, you know, but it's, I don't know. That's a weird cloud to hang over, you know, a bigger picture of a really entertaining World Series that just got a 2020 curve at the end of the day.
You know, the thing about that kind of got to me. Is, you know, so he got a positive test before the game. And now this is where, and look, I stay off of Twitter more often than not these days because I think a lot of people can be a little bit ridiculous. But, you know, just less than a month ago, the WNBA actually postponed their championship series because several members of the Seattle Storm were exposed to the virus or believed to have been exposed to the virus. And there may have been a positive test. They delayed it for just a night, you know, which is incredible. They were thorough about it, and they had said, all right, we're going to make sure that everybody's fine. And it turned out they were fine. Nobody else, you know, it wasn't anything. And the fact that that didn't happen in this case, I understand people have been sort of upset, but I think there's been precedent so far this year, this really horrible year, to say, you know, we got to be thorough. And the fact that baseball itself didn't say, Justin, chill, right? Mm-hmm. We knew how important he was, but like in the overarching things, as angry as people would have been about it, there'd have been some understanding in that if baseball just said, hey, Justin, we need you to sit out today. You know, you have to sit out tonight. And it's game six of the World Series. Maybe we could have gone to the seventh game. Maybe Turner would have came back for game seven. And the Rays would have won. And people would have been angry at baseball for sitting, for having Justin Turner sit out. But the greater picture of all of this is that we have a virus that's killing people. We have a virus that is out here ravaging the world in a way that we've never seen before. And any sort of precaution that is taken by an organization that has decided to usurp all these resources to get their World Series going, you can appreciate them taking things seriously. I don't want to get super personal here, but my son is currently attending this sort of toddler program. And a couple weeks ago, it was believed that there was a kid who was exposed to a relative, and the school shut down for the week. Even though everybody was fine, they tested everybody, everything was all well and good. And we were disappointed they shut down, but we appreciated that they were so thorough to make sure that everybody was okay, that the exposure wasn't going to affect anything else. The school has resources, not the resources of like Major League Baseball, but mm-hmm. It's like, come on. You can make the decision to say, for one night, we're going to just push things back a little bit more and we'll see what happens. Or just say, Justin Turner, sit down and let's just make sure we can keep things going. Like, that is the frustration I have with the decision that was made or not made by baseball. I'm more upset at Major League Baseball than I am the Dodgers or Turner himself.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the thing. I mean, just because, at the end of the day, guys are going to do what they're going to do.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, at this time when there's so many things that are up in the air about, people wanting to say, hey, I this is right, this is wrong, the morality of the situation, the considering of other people and all those things. Yeah, I mean, there's no real one right way to view it, I suppose. I know my opinion is if you know better, do better, mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's how I see it. But, am I right? I'm right for me. But the notion of collective responsibility amongst Americans right now is not something that I'm holding my breath waiting to see happen. But that's much bigger, broader conversation for another time. One thing I want to say is we see the Dodgers get off of a 32-year slide. Crazy. That's the first title since the Gibson home run title of 88. But so what other teams, let me put it this way. We all know the handful of teams that are out there that are due. There's time to come up and get that done. But what's the next team that you could see getting off of a skid like this across, let's say, across the four longest sports in America?
That is a really good question because – I mean, first of all, I think it's more likely in baseball to happen than it is anywhere else at this point. We've already seen it trend in a certain way. And so if Cleveland chooses to spend money, it could be them. Maybe they're the ones who can actually, you have a great manager in Terry Francona. Maybe if they actually finally make those extra moves to sort of make things happen and to add and keep the right personnel around over the next couple of years. I mean, it's a decision of keeping Francisco Lindor and trying to build around him a little bit further. I always feel like they're, sort of that next team up in baseball. And because what we've already seen from baseball, I feel like they're more likely to do it than teams in other sports. However, if you want to flip over to other sports, it may be the Milwaukee Bucks. I think it may surprise folks and prove they want to keep Giannis Antetokounmpo all around. And if they choose to do that and make that right move, maybe they do trade for Chris Paul. Which is something that I think maybe they should have done this past season to get them over the hump and get, just try to retinker the roster a little bit, especially the bench, get a little more depth. I think the Milwaukee Bucks can probably break their sort of malaise, if you will, and bring home their first title since the 70s. I think it's still gonna be a little bit tougher because, you know, the Eastern Conference is a lot more interesting than people think. So, you know, maybe they're that sort of next team up that does it. Football, I almost kind of don't care in a way. But football, it's kind of, football is just very weird. We're like, I think most people kind of want to be the Cowboys in a way because we keep talking about the Cowboys forever and ever. They're clearly not going to do it. Definitely not this year.
This isn't the year for it.
Definitely not this year, and maybe not next year. But it seems like they're like that team that's supposed to break their sort of dry spell. But then also you flip around and people are still waiting for the Cleveland Browns to do something, and the Cleveland Browns keep telling us it ain't going to happen. Even though their record is actually better than expected right now, are they a team that's going to win the Super Bowl? No.
I throw out a couple of teams that I think I would be akin to agree with you about the Indians. However, I mean, I don't think Francisco Lindor ever puts that uniform on again.
No, probably not.
You know, I mean, I just think that we're at the end of the road with that portion of, you know, of Indians history. So when you're losing a guy of that caliber, you know, I guess it goes one of two ways. You know, you could get to a point where you rally around your lost star, certainly did that here in St. Louis, and were able to keep the team competitive and in that window. So it can happen. You know, the Indians
from the last year.
Exactly. And, you know, with Bryce Harper transitioning, but, you know, the Indians are on a 72-year skid. You know, I mean, with the Cubs, the Nationals, and the Dodgers all getting off the slide in baseball over the last couple of years, you would think that the Indians might be up. You know, there's another couple of teams that kind of flirt with getting over the hump that are right there. You know, you've got the Rangers, who have never won one, the Brewers, the Padres. Maybe the Padres are next. You know, they're 52 years in their existence and haven't won yet. You know, maybe it's the Oakland A's, who are 31 years removed and certainly have a lot of talent to do those things. Maybe it's the Atlanta Braves, who are 25 years removed from their last title. But
and you this know, could have been it if not for it was ugly.
It would have been a run. I like that call out in the NBA about the Bucks. You know, they're 49 years since their last title. You know, coming into this year, it sounded like the Clippers wouldn't get to 50 years, you know, let a lot of people tell it, you know. The Denver Nuggets are 44 years in existence without a title. You know, the Brooklyn Nets are geared up, you know, superstarred up 44 years as well. Interesting situations there. I think the Nets, it's not going to necessarily click like that. But, you know, you never know. I think that of all of those teams that you mentioned, there's some duds in football that just have been historically duds for so long. 62 years for the Lions, 51 years for the Jets, 47 for the Browns, 43 for the Vikings, 35 years for the Dolphins, 31 years for the Bengals, who have 29 straight playoff losses. You know, then you get down to the Cowboys, you know, 24 years. A couple of teams we skipped over, the Bills, the Jaguars, the Chargers. I don't see it happening for them. Probably the team that has the most feasibility to get it done here in the immediate sense would be the Tampa Bay Bucks, who are 17 years removed, or the Tennessee Titans, who are 20 years removed from the last time they went. You know, the Cardinals have never. There's six teams have. Seven teams who have never won a Super Bowl. You know that are right there. And then if you count some of the more recent expansion teams in. Like the Panthers and the Texans, and I'm sorry, the Falcons and the Bengals haven't won either. You know, there's some punishment in the NFL that way. Last team I'll bring up before we turn the page on the who's next, and I'll say the team I think that gets next. I agree with you. The Bucks, I think, have the closest chance. A couple of it might have a chance. The Toronto Maple Leafs, who are long.
They're so interesting because, I mean, last year it seemed like maybe that could have been it. Maybe. You know, the stars seem to have aligned. I remember my wife and I, we were in 2018, we were in Toronto for like, well, we didn't realize it was Canadian Thanksgiving weekend, but it was like, it was Indigenous Peoples Day weekend here in the States. I'm not going to call it what its other name is. And we were in Toronto and we're having dinner at the top of the CN Tower. Beautiful. First of all, Toronto's an amazing city, beautiful city.
Yeah.
Can't wait to go back when you know, American responsible Americans are allowed to travel again.
When they'll have us, yes.
But, you know, I'm seeing the what's now the Scotiabank Arena, what it's called now. I'm seeing, you know, the Leafs had a game that night. I think it was like opening. I don't remember if it was opening night or not, or close to opening night. And the buzz there was incredible. It was very much like, you know, when the Cardinals are on and like, you know, contending. Mm-hmm. It was a beautiful buzz there. But it seemed like they built a roster that had everything together. Then they add Jonathan Tavares. Now they got Joe Thornton, who is, you know, Hall of Famer on the way. And it feels like they're still trying to make those moves. And now with, you know, a change behind the bench and all that, it's like you feel like they can be the team, not just for Toronto, but for Canada in general. Canada hasn't had Canada saw the cup lifted this past year, but it just wasn't anywhere their teams. Mm-hmm. But like, you know, they haven't had a cup raised by one of their teams since 93 of Montreal.
Yeah, and although they had the Raptors last year, there still would be nothing like a Canadian team winning the Stanley Cup.
And especially if it's the Leafs. Especially if it's the Leafs. You know, the Leafs have had this incredible realm of futility. And like their futility has been like, you know, the way people talk about it up there, it is almost like, you know, it's rage. Like people are just, there's just so much anger about how the Leafs have been like there, but then not. You know, they blew a lead to the Bruins in the playoffs a couple years back. These heartbreaking ways that they've actually gone to lose. And you feel like they're the team that can sort of break out, especially because the resources are there. Mm-hmm. What I do think would be interesting this time around is you know, how the NHL resources are going to sort of dwindle because of COVID, and what the Leafs are able to do to tinker the franchise a little bit more in order to try to get themselves over the hump. But again, adding Joe Thornton should be a little bit of a help in terms of that, you know, maybe second or third line sort of help there. But I think the Leafs can probably be that team. But the NHL is full of really interesting franchises that, you know, there are curses, and then there's like this weird sort of almost baseball-like parody to the NHL right now. But the crazy part is I'd expect the Vegas Golden Knights to win a Stanley Cup before the Toronto Maple Leafs. And that's how crazy things are. The Seattle Kraken could come in a year or so and win the Stanley Cup in their first season because of the way that the franchise is being built. Like, that's how crazy this stuff is. A team that has been dying to win the Cup, or at least play for the Cup, could lose it a squad that just got here. And it almost happened before. So it's a really interesting sort of state of the NHL.
Yeah, it's no telling. The NHL is most certainly one of the most unpredictable, you know, leagues that there is out there. So who knows what's going to happen there. But I think that for me, the Bucks, the Clippers, the Leafs would be a great story. I mean, I feel like I empathize with them based on how the Blues finally got over the hump. But, you know, who knows how that could work out. Hopefully we'll get to a point where we'll see that. Couple of things real quick before we get out of here today. And I know that all right, man, before we get out of here, I want to, you know, I would be criminally out of place if I didn't mention that the most esteemed Lewis Hamilton reached the top of the mountaintop. And I'm going to say the top of the mountaintop because there was that tie with him and Michael Schumacher. And you never know how long a tie is going to last, how long it's going to take to get off of that. I should have known better with Lewis Hamilton that it didn't take long. 92 Formula One wins of all time. The record holder in the middle of a season that's just come to define him personally and professionally. Thoughts about what the living legend did here.
And those are the most appropriate words. You want to talk about a living legend? It's Lewis Hamilton passing another living legend in Michael Schumacher. And what was amazing about what Hamilton has done is, you know, there are these clips I had watched before we got on the show. One actually is a 17-minute clip of him crossing the finish line for every single one of his wins. Also, he podiumed close to 150 times, which in itself is incredible.
Mm-hmm.
But the second video that got me was, it went through like Formula One history of like, you know, the guys who set the record and broke the record of most podium wins, right? The records went from like 25 to like 50. Jackie Stewart had 50, I think it was. And then all of a sudden, Michael Schumacher showed up and he got to 91. To go from 50 to 91 makes no damn sense.
Yeah.
And then you have Hamilton, who, let's keep in mind, he can still keep going. You know, Lewis Hamilton is 35 years old.
Yeah.
And the guy can, he's going to get at least 100 wins. If the way he is going, he's going to get at least 100 wins. And you wonder how long it'll be until somebody comes close to matching him. What he's been able to do is incredible.
So let me ask you then, you know, Lewis Hamilton is starting to hit that level where it's, you know, rarefied air. I mean, when you start talking about in the history of sports, I'll throw a couple of people out there. Tell me, you don't have to rank them. Tell me if Lewis is the best amongst them at peak form. Tiger Woods, peak form. Compared to his body of work compared to the rest of golf. Michael Phelps, you know, what he was doing in the pool, just the nature of what his Olympic dominance was. Usain Bolt, and just the distance he put on the records that he had there. Serena Williams, that mm-hmm. type of thing. Like, where does Lewis Hamilton fit into that hierarchy of athlete of just what he's doing and the peak that he's at?
I think he's up there with all of them. I think he's
Floyd Mayweather. I'm sorry, there was another one I put in there.
He's up there. He's up there. He's in the class. He's in that class with them. And how he's done it has been remarkable. Obviously, changing teams a couple of times, like from Williams to McLaren to Mercedes. This team he has. I mean, yes, it's an individual sport, but it's a great team he has as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, and respect to a mentor of his who passed away last year, and Niki Lauda. Who himself was a great driver. You know, when you can sit at the feet of a legend to learn more about how to be dominant and to dominate yourself, and to also just what he's been able to do has been incredible. But let's also, I'm going to be a little bit biased at this. Like, he also seems to be like a really good person too. He seems to be like an actually decent human being. Yeah. And we see that through his stances and stuff like that, but also, for those folks who are watching this right now, do yourselves a favor. David Letterman has a great series on Netflix. Go watch Lewis Hamilton's interview on that. Phenomenal. You really get a sense of who he is, who his father is. You get some, and you're like, this is why people root for this man.
Because and the thing I'll say about that Letterman interview is just the overcomes it took for him to get there. Everything he's at, he's earned. And I know that that's the case for a lot of people, but he had to really break some barriers to even get there in the first place. And there was a family sacrifice. So there's a lot that's gone into that. Yeah. Couple of other things that we had real quick, about a week or so ago, but still is never the wrong time to talk about it. The Lopez Lomachenko fight.
Oh man, that was fun.
What a perfect time for that. You know, I mean, I still, boxing is still one of my four favorite sports. And yeah, I mean,
same.
What a perfect, you hear so many people say, you know, is boxing dead, you know, which I always find to be ludicrous. Does it have its ebbs and flows? Sure. Are there too many belts? Absolutely.
Yeah.
But for that fight to come on during the pandemic on absolute free TV free enough. It's not a pay-per-view. It's on cable still with ESPN, but you don't have to pay an extra price for it. So anybody could stream on and watch it. That was the perfect time for that to happen. And boy, did it deliver.
What a fight. You know, Teofimo Lopez is outstanding. And like, he's young, he's 24. He has the brashness and the talent. Like, I seen a couple of his fights. I'm like, oh, you knew he was powerful, but going against Vasily Lomachenko, like, that was some power.
Yeah.
And you know, that was some real legitimate power with some good speed. Solid defense too. I think people sort of overlooked that part. Like, you know, Lomo was able to kind of get in there for a couple rounds later on. But like, honestly, when he was dominating, he also just moved incredibly well to not give Lomo that target. It's going to be fun watching him into this game. He's 24 years old and is a lightweight heavyweight champion of the world. And this era of boxing has been much more defined by the lower weights, if you will, than the heavyweights. Yeah. And to see another guy of this age kind of get in there now, does he enter that class of you know, Saul Canelo Alvarez, we don't know just yet, but like, he has enough time to prove that he can get there. I think he's gonna be great for the fight game. And it was great. I'm glad you mentioned that was on ESPN. I think that's what also made it such a special thing. It allowed much more people to get excited about the fight rather than, I think this past week was a fight card, but it was a pay-per-view.
Yeah.
And it's like, right now we don't need pay-per-view. Like, we really don't need pay-per-view. And at a time, especially now that for the most part, for most people, the only sport that's going on is football right now. So for anybody to do a pay-per-view card right now, when there is such an incredible, unique void of sports, like this is the time to switch that crap up. And if you put the guys, if you put the fighters together that want to fight, hell, there's a potentially great women's fight out there between Clarissa Shields and Katie Taylor at some point. If you can get the fights together, there's an audience who is dying to see it happen.
Yeah, and we'll watch.
And we will watch. And we'll watch. And if you're and good we'll enough. And if while you're we're good enough, talking, you will be a star.
And while we're there talking about that fight, obviously the main event was amazing. I mean, I love the sequence that it happened in, that there were, you know, Lopez dominated for four rounds, four or five rounds. And then you get to the point where Lomachenko comes in and, you knew he was going to come. You knew it was going to happen. But just the fight that Lopez put into that final round showed the type of grit and the type of just determination that just made me say, I don't know how this guy, Lomachenko was the pound for pound coming into that fight. It's up in the air now. I saw Floyd Mayweather say, it needs to be Terrence Crawford. I know a lot of people to say Errol Spence should be considered the pound for pound. For me, you just mentioned his name. Canelo Alvarez fights at literally any weight he wants to, it seems, and wins. Probably shouldn't go to heavyweight, but I wouldn't put it past him. But I mean, it's a really diverse time in the fight game.
Absolutely.
And you've got heavyweights that are good right now. You've got heavyweights that are skilled and with things like that too. And I'm gonna tell you what though, there was another revelation on that card, and it was Edgar Berlanga. Oh my God. Oh my God. Something. I mean, he's fighting 45 second fights. Like this is ridiculous.
One round, like because it was the first time I've seen him fight. And you're like, all right, is this for real? Like, is this really real? And then just power. And like, it was.
He was punching guys in the face and it sounded like he was hitting a heavy bag. I was like, get that guy out of there. He doesn't need to be fighting.
That was something. But you know what? This thing, and while we'll get into it, I'm not as much into mixed martial arts, but when there is a young person that's coming up, with the proper skill, the proper training, and you know somebody's gonna be next. And when you see a guy who, I hate cliches like big stage, this, that, and the other, but like the guy really showed up on the biggest stage of his life and showed you why he had all those wins within the first round. He showed you why he's legit. Now, he'll get tested a little bit more as he gets, he's not gonna have first round knockouts forever, but we're gonna find out who he is. And I think that's the thing that fascinates me about him. I want to see his journey as he gets into that second round, the third round. Like, he's going to have to go the distance a little bit more. And that's when we find out who folks are.
Yeah, that's where the skill sets in. That's where the endurance sets in. That's where the science comes in at it. So, you mentioned mixed martial arts. And last weekend, I was so happy that my buddy reminded me that the fight was coming on at noon, because I didn't want to miss what I figured would be the fight of the year in the UFC with with Khabib Nurmagomedov. I'm so terrible at it. I knew I was going to mess it up. Khabib the Eagle. I'm sorry. That's so racist to not be able to say it, but it's just, I struggle with that. I struggle with Giannis still. I'm sorry.
It takes some time.
You had that.
I struggle with it too, but I have to read it as I see it. Nurmagomedov.
Yeah, there you go.
Say it slow.
I get lost.
You want to try.
I know how it ends and I know how it stops. So that's.
I at least want to show. Here's the thing, Matt. Like, if you show you put in the effort, somebody will help you out. That's fine. But you don't want to be dismissive of the name.
No, and I don't. And I've always told the line of saying, do I even start it if I'm going to disrespect it in trying to say it? So it's. I don't know. My last name's been messed up my entire life. I don't know how people look at Whitener and get Whitner, but I guess. But
it's mangled all the time too.
His fight against Justin Gaethje, I knew it was going to be a great fight, but what I underestimated was the greatness of Khabib and just how much he just made it not be a great fight. I mean, Gaethje, it decimates other people. But Khabib
came in and I saw some clips of that. And I'm just like, yeah, this is the guy who beat the holy snot out of Conor McGregor. And, and I think that's why and that's the interesting thing, like, about him, about Khabib. It's like, the man has bad intentions at all times when he gets in an octagon. And like, mm-hmm. he wants about motivation to do bad things to you. Like, it doesn't take much for him. But man, like that was impressive. Like, you, this is supposed to be the big fight, and he just says, nah. Like, I actually like moments like that sometimes.
I do too.
The athletes who are like, oh, you expect it to be this. Oh, you think it's just gonna be, and he's like, nah, nah.
No, it's not.
I'm gonna show you who I am, and it's that's pretty good. Awesome.
Right. Yeah. And for him to do that, I mean, and I think that, you know, and just obviously the last two fights he's had, you know, with McGregor, he certainly had a level of determination in that fight that was unlike anything else. But for him to come out and have this fight, and, you know, and at the end of the fight, I was just like, what happens with this guy? You know, like who steps up to the plate? I mean, everybody has their day eventually. But I was like, I just don't see where it went. Like, what's next for him? And then a couple of seconds later, he lays his gloves down and says, that's it. You know, because obviously, you know, the what happened with his father and COVID-19 and losing him and just how tightly intertwined they were. And then the story that he tells about, you know, about his mother not wanting him to fight without his father. And he's saying that he had to finish that piece of business, but then leave it all behind. Just the character, you know, in a guy like that. And you know what?
Yeah.
I think that we've seen it enough times in sports that we say, well, you know, we'll see. I believe him.
Yeah, it's hard. This is a man of such great conviction from, you know, the things I've read about him, the things I've seen about him. He has such great conviction. I mean, again, we mentioned in the whole Conor McGregor sort of rivalry there. And I think part of the reason why it was sort of easy to kind of get on his side is because you saw how disrespected that Khabib was. You know, by McGregor, and mm-hmm. and it's just like you got to stop testing these people. You got to stop testing these people. He's a man of his own, and people can say what they will about faith, but this is a man of strong faith and strong convictions. You know, he's the first Muslim fighter to win a UFC belt, mm-hmm. which I think is sort of a overlooked thing in a way, but I think it's very important to sort of note there. But you know, when I heard about that, about you know, him making this promise that this would be it. Like I just wonder how many people could ever go through something like that. But when you've seen what he's already done in his career, and it's kind of like, oh no, you absolutely believe it. Like that is a rarity amongst rarities.
Yeah.
It's rarer than somebody other than Lewis Hamilton at the podium, right? it is a rarity amongst rarities. To see that kind of conviction and an athlete, an active athlete. And there are going to be plenty of opportunities for him. People are going to be throwing money at him, throwing all sorts of sums at him to sort of try to bring him back, especially UFC, which is a very top-heavy organization.
Mm-hmm.
So it won't be surprising.
And one that's been impacted by the pandemic as far as a pipeline.
Hugely.
You know what I mean? They're dealing with a lot of people that are just the ones they have. And that's a sport where you need to have new people coming through all the time. And you need to have people that are fighting regularly and striving for those spots. And they've been the one promotion that I think that's really been able to figure out a way to get back, but it's because they have the resources to do it. There's a lot of other mixed martial artists and boxers as well that aren't fighting because they're not at that level yet. And it's going to be interesting to see how that impacts the sport. But, you know, the thing with Khabib is that, you know, I think he instantly enters that stratosphere of like Barry Sanders and Jim Brown, you know, guys of that ilk, Floyd Mayweather, that go out at the very top of their game. And, you know, and that's it. And I like that. I like that right off into the sunset. And I believe him. And it's really was a pleasure. I think he enters that conversation in just in UFC terms with your George St. Pierre's, with your Anderson Silva's, you know, with the greats, mm-hmm. truly great guys of all time in it. Last thing I'll say before we go, while we're talking about the fight game, let's talk about the other side of the fight game too. It's something that came over as we were sitting here talking. Mike Tyson has made his intentions clear for his fight against Roy Jones. He said he's more, and I'm going to quote the legend as we talk about short fights. and you can please listen to this in his voice. It helps out. my mindset is totally bliss. This is something I've done all my life since I was 13 years old. I'm more evolved now than I've ever been. My objective is to go in there with the best intentions of my life and to disable my opponent. And that just is what it is.
Why do we have to add more commentary to that?
I love it. I love it. This fight, I'll say, this is a fight that at first when it was mentioned, I was kind of like, I don't really need a Veterans Day in the boxing ring. I'm here for this now because Mike obviously has been training. I still think it doesn't get much longer than two or three rounds, maybe at the most, hook or by crook. But I missed the simple joy of a crazy Mike Tyson presser, and I get it back, and that makes me happy just to get that.
I'll say this though, like, you know, his name has made rounds recently also because of a clip that ESPN's Pablo Torre had shared about Mike Tyson's podcast and just the emotions behind that particular interview he did with Boosie. And it's going to be interesting. If you want to talk about a press conference, like, how interesting would it be to see that Mike Tyson, maybe not, you know, high as a kite, but or maybe he would be, who knows. But, you know, if that Mike Tyson kind of shows up. I mean, we also saw a clip of him from that same podcast where he interviews Sugar Ray Leonard. And he talks about how, like, he misses being the monster and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, he's crying. And look, you know, there are a lot of these Generation Z folks who question Mike. I mean, listen, folks our age who question Mike Tyson in general, you know, of who he was in the ring, you know, if he was as good as believed, right? Mm-hmm. But there's never been a fighter that made grown men of all ages just, like, yo, say, I'm not messing with this dude. Like, they're very, and listen, I wouldn't mess with any boxer, right? We just talked about, you know, these guys who just dominate, right? I ain't messing with any boxer. I ain't stupid.
No.
But Mike Tyson still remains the only guy, the only fighter, whether it's mixed martial arts or boxing, that everybody just says, yeah, I ain't fucking with that dude. Like it remains this way. And I think that says a lot about not just the aura that he built, but also understanding and knowing the things that he has done in the ring, knowing the person that he is away from it, knowing his life story for better or for worse, unfortunately knowing all the savory unsavory things that are part of his life. And when people can just say, like, I'm nah, you can have that.
Nobody has more street cred than Mike Tyson, and it's going to stay that way. And once again, we finished where we started at, New York's own.
That's right.
Jason, where can everybody catch up with you at?
You can find me at a sports on Twitter at a sports scribe, ASPORTSSCRIBE. Just find me on Twitter. I gotta spell it every time, but just find me there. And I don't know. I don't know when we'll be writing next, but we'll be. Hopefully, you see something from me pretty soon. But at least find me on Twitter. I'll be nice. Just be nice.
And also find you here, Jason. You'll definitely be back. We appreciate you. Before we get out of here, as always, man, I got to put the team over. I got to put everything out there. You know, shout out to the whole SOLC crew. We got a new episode that actually just dropped, the second half of our conversation on politics as usual, talking about amendments, talking about, you know, what goes into writing, the things that appear on your ballot. So you understand what that looks like and you understand what that means. Like, you know, voter education is kind of what the second half of this second episode of politics as usual means. We have a new episode of the commentary that's out next week. I will be sitting in with the crew for the We're Coming For You podcast, Black Wrestling commentary. We got some things.
What a name.
We gotta get into
it. What a name.
It's easily the best intro on the entire network. We all need to get intros remixed by Brother RVS. And of course, man, always stay tuned. We always have different things coming. The long-awaited I don't know if we can call it a return, the long-awaited next episode of The Scenario, just regular Scenario, not Scenario Sports, is coming up imminently as well. There's plenty of things to talk about. We are going to be dropping a classic episode of Scenario. Probably we'll get that on the feed today when this one drops, going back into the incel episode and talking about the Halloween pimping. So we'll get back to that one soon. But
what names?
Again, thanks to Jason. Hey, get with us all. We'll be here soon. Stay locked in. Appreciate y'all. Peace.
Take care, folks. Take care.